How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We are here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. We have a very special show for you here today. We are not going to talk anything that is going on right now in the world of pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. What we're going to do is we're going to talk some history. We are going to talk today about the history of World Championship Wrestling. Many of you listening to this right now were brought up or grew up or became fans again during the Monday Night Wars, the period from 1995 through 2001, when Raw and Nitro went head-to-head in an epic battle in which, in the end, there was, in fact, one winner and one loser. WCW, in March of 2001, was sold a fire sale, as they say, to WWF for basically about $2.5 million. Which, if you consider the amount of money that they made when they were at their peak, preposterous. They lost millions and millions and millions of dollars the last couple of years. We're going to talk about the rise and fall of WCW on this show. There have been many DVDs put out about this. Obviously, WWE put one out. I put out a book about this very subject, The Death of WCW, myself and R.D. Reynolds. It is available right now on Amazon.com. Many bookstores still carry the book. It's been in print for half a decade now, believe it or not, and it is still available. So if you want to head out there and get your hands on that, it is, if I do say so myself, a classic. And perhaps one of these days we will go through that book and update it and expand it. The original book was actually much, much longer than the final copy. CW Press at the time had not put out a lot of wrestling books, and so we had a word limit. Those days are gone, but this, of course, was back in 2004 when we put this book together. So nowadays, we could go through and add tons and tons of interviews and tons of tidbits, and we could put a lot of news and tidbits back into the book. So perhaps someday that's going to happen. But for today, a primer. We'll see how much of it we can get through here today, but we're going to focus on the time prior to the Monday Night Wars, the time after the Monday Night Wars, and maybe a wrap-up. What happened after WWF bought WCW? What happened to the industry? What happened to the business? And more. So that's all coming up today. Should be a fun show. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com. We are joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here for 2 hours every Sunday night, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Sports Byline USA, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 94, XM Radio Channel 208, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, and streaming online worldwide at WrestlingObserver.com. Here today, talking no current news, no pro wrestling or mixed martial arts news. In the world we are living in today, it does not exist. Instead, we are going back a historical look at the rise and fall and the death of WCW. And Mike, what are your overall memories of WCW as a company? A success? A failure? Obviously, it went out of business, but for a while there, it seemed to be a success. Your overall take on the history of WCW?
It was a remarkable supernova in those years that everyone's always going to remember, which is the Monday Night Wars era. I'm a little bit older, and I grew up in right in between Baltimore and Washington. So we were a battleground for Jim Crockett Promotions in the WWF throughout the 80s. And I was very partial towards Jim Crockett Promotions. I mean, my favorite promotion was Mid-South, but I really love Crockett because it was hard to, as a kid, not love, you know, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat and the Horsemen. And, you know, I grew up on that. It was a more realistic style. It wasn't as cartoony. It was, you know, I liked the interviews more, and I was always, you know, drawn into those things. And that blood of Crockett Promotions was, you know, it was bastardized along the way when they sold to Turner. When they were basically had to, because he was going out of business. But basically, that same blood, you know, ran through and ran down into the WCW that the people remember from the 90s. And I just remember it was such a culture shock and a change when the NWO came in and when Hall and Nash came in and everything started to change and they dramatically, you know, jettisoned themselves from that old school era. And it became what it became, and it took off. It was amazing to watch it beat the WWF after years and years and years of always having to play second fiddle, and then just like that, with some bizarre things that had gone on, and all the wackiness and politics and debauchery and everything else that took place, to see it explode and make so much money and pack the Georgia Dome with 80,000 people, and then to see it fizzle out at the end and see them having to tarp off shows and only getting 1,000 people for Nitro. It was an absolute amazing thing to watch, business-wise, psychologically, just everything. It was great for everything except if you were a wrestling fan, especially one from that Crockett era, because as we've seen, those people never came back. When they tuned out, they never went to WWE. They just tuned out completely and they stayed away.
When people think of the end of WCW, they think of the Vince Russo booking era and Kevin Nash, Kevin Sullivan, Eric Bischoff. There was a lot of horrible, horrible booking in WCW back in the day. I think a lot of fans that started watching wrestling during the Monday Night Wars, or maybe started during the end of the Monday Night Wars, or maybe are very young right now and have heard a lot about it, but weren't there for the early part of the 90s. One thing that people need to realize is that when you think of stupid things happening in WCW, this was not something that was exclusive to the end of the decade. There were stupid things that happened in WCW all the time. And I don't know if... you could look back to... I remember when Ric Flair was fired and ended up going to WWF at the time, and showed up on TV the first time with that championship, because he had physical possession of the NWA belt based on the way things used to be with the NWA, which was that you put down a deposit on the belt, and that guaranteed that you would lose the belt. If they told you to drop the title to so-and-so and you didn't, they'd keep your $25,000. And Flair had made his deposit. The deposit was not returned to him, and so he felt, okay, I own this belt. And he took the belt to WWF, and of course, this became a legal issue, and before you know it, there was a replica belt, and then it was one of the tag team belts or something like that, just the whole idea of getting rid of Ric Flair, and then there were We Want Flair chants at WCW shows forever, and then, of course, he finally returned, and, you know, you look at the booking, the early part of the decade as well, and certainly it was not nearly as bad as things were at the end under Vince Russo, but there were still a lot of things, titles changing hands, and I'm trying to think of some of the weird things that happened during some of those television tapings in the mid-90s.
That was the whole thing. The inmates basically ended up running the asylum far before WCW was even there, with Dusty overspending with Crockett and the mess they were in, and things weren't organized. The one thing with Vince that everyone had always said was the buck stopped there. That was it. What he said was the law, and they were incredibly organized. They were a professionally run business, and wrestling was blowing up at the time, and they could not run it like a professional business. WCW just could never do it. And then when they sold to Turner, it was even worse, because they were just a branch of a company that wanted absolutely nothing to do with them whatsoever. They were mocked. They didn't care. They had non-wrestling people put in charge. I mean, some of the things when they went to TV tapings where they would film things out of sequence, mm-hmm. and then get upset when the word got out about these things and it screwed up their TV shows. Well, for God's sakes, you're taping a month in advance and you're supposed to be a major company. Of course word's going to get out and titles are going to change and injuries happen, things like that. Just mass disorganization, issues with pay-per-view, with promotion, just the whole nine yards. They were in deep, deep trouble, and they were just an incredible mess. No matter how good a lot of the wrestling matches were, you know, when you look at the time of Doom and the Horsemen, and there were a lot of great guys there, but the problem wasn't the in-ring work, which was always great. It was everything else that went around it.
The thing with WCW is, even during that period, I mean, no matter what happened, no matter what kind of stupid decision they made, no matter how rinky-dink or whatever the promotion looked like, the thing that I always heard and that everyone always said was, well, it's never going out of business. You know, the beginning of death of WCW starts, I think, with the quote, WCW was never meant to die. Or was never supposed to die, I believe is what the term was. It was never supposed to die. That's just what everybody said. It's not going to die. You know, because when Ted Turner started his superstation, the first program in the history of the world, in fact, that ever drew more than 1 million viewers on his superstation and on cable. I guess it was satellite, whatever you want to call it. But it was wrestling. It was professional wrestling. And so as a result of that, Ted Turner was never going to cancel the wrestling program. He was always going to be there. In fact, there were periods where the company was doing so bad that meetings would regularly be called, and the discussion would come about, should we get rid of this WCW? And Ted Turner would always say no. And finally, one day, he just said, we're not getting rid of it. Don't ever ask me again. And, of course, at the end of the day, when the company finally ended up going out of business, Ted Turner had been moved out of a position of power where he could save the company. But, you know, up until that whole situation went down, and I don't want to overstate the AOL Time Warner merger, which I know a lot of people like to do is stating why the company went out of business. But up until that period, I mean, as long as he was in charge, it was like it didn't matter. You know, Ted Turner and Turner Broadcasting owned this company, and it was not going out of business. And that's all everybody believed, and so it was just remarkable when the day came when finally it was gone. And there were a lot of periods during the early 90s, before the Monday Night Wars, where discussions were made about closing this place down or selling or attempting to sell or whatever, and Turner put his foot down every time.
Yeah, and that was, you know, it gave him the ratings, it built his empire. And it was amazing at the end when he was forced out of his position when he had sold to AOL Time Warner, and he was very upset when he found out he had no control over the networks. And it was just, it was an amazing thing. You know, WCW was always the corporate business, and it was never run like one. The WWF, on the flip side, was a family-run business that operated as a corporate machine. And yes, the AOL Time Warner, obviously that move when they decided to axe it, yeah, that killed it. But, you know, it was coming far before that.
We are going to jump into the Monday Night Wars here. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about some of the history that led to that Hulk Hogan jumping ship and how this whole thing began. The first shots fired. It's all coming up after the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here for the next hour and a half talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. Well, sort of. We're talking the death of WCW. This show is going to be completely on the history of the rise and fall of World Championship Wrestling. Now, granted, we've only got 2 hours. So some of this stuff, we're going to jump around. Some of this stuff, we're going to... I remember when I wrote Death of WCW, people were like, oh my God, I can't believe there was nothing about the Wolf Pack in the book. And people were very, very upset about no mention of the Wolf Pack. And again, there was a lot of stuff cut out of that book. And in the grand scheme of the universe, the Wolfpack did not make or break WCW. And there will probably be things in the course of the next hour and a half that we skip over. But we're going to try and give you the general story. What happened? What happened during this Monday Night War that has become kind of the, I guess some people would say, one of the more important periods in the history of the business? And perhaps at the end of the show, we could argue whether the Monday Night Wars was, in fact, good for the business or not. A lot of different ways to look at that. So, Mike, let's get into this here. The we got to keep moving forward here. The jump of Hulk Hogan from WWF to WCW, history has changed that story somewhat. There's a lot of, I mean, there are people probably, I'm sure if you read a bunch of Bischoff interviews and things other people have written and said about how WCW raided Hulk Hogan and this sort of thing, which in fact never happened. Hulk Hogan had actually been done with WWF for a while. He had left the company. This was after his loss to Yokozuna in 1993. I believe it was the King of the Ring. I can't even remember the exact. I'm pretty sure it was King of the Ring. And he had won the title from Yokozuna. They wanted him to drop the belt to Bret Hart. He refused. He felt that Bret Hart was too small. And so he opted instead to lose the title to Yokozuna, who was, in fact, big, at which point he left WWF. And it was almost a year later they ended up signing with WCW. And this would have been 94. And as a lot of people are well aware, Hulk Hogan did not immediately turn WCW business around. There were some good signs. There were some bad signs. But it was not an immediate rehabilitation of the company, which I think is why when you look forward to the debut of Nitro, I will never forget this. The week before Nitro, I had already I'd been writing my newsletter for a while. Dave had been writing his newsletter for well over a decade. Wade Keller had been doing the torch for like I believe 7 years at that point. And I think everybody in the entire world except Wade. Wade Keller was the only person that I remember writing that Nitro going head-to-head with Raw was going to be a success. Pretty much everybody else thought this was going to be an epic failure. And I think that was probably one of the reasons. The fact that Hulk Hogan showed up. As I said, there were some very good business business turnarounds in some areas. Pay-per-view, obviously, did very well for his matches. But in other ways, it did not turn the business around. And so I think a lot of people thought that you know, the idea of doing this Nitro head-to-head with Raw and bringing back these stars from the 80s wasn't going to be the type of thing that was going to turn business around. But in fact, it did. So, Mike, we'll start with thoughts on Hulk Hogan jumping to WCW.
You know, it was a heck of a gamble. You know, he was down there filming Thunder in Paradise at Universal Studios, and he was out of the mix. And, you know, he was not a WCW guy. That can't be stressed enough. You know, he just wasn't. Those cartoon characters and those guys, you know, there was always resentment from the fan base. So, you know, Hogan coming down was already, you know, a risky proposition as it was for a fan base that, you know, obviously certain people liked him and there was nostalgia and all that, but it was like, you know, come on, he's done with WWF, we're tired of this. And could it really work? And obviously, as time went on, it proved that with the change in culture and him needing to reinvent himself, obviously, you know what happened. But I got to be honest, I wasn't a big fan of it, and lots of people I know were not. But with that said, you know, he was the biggest, flashiest name out there. He is the name, he was the only name out there that could actually move a needle, and they didn't sell their souls, but they obviously gave him a very, very huge sweetheart deal where he got such a massive cut of his pay-per-view revenue, which, you know, for at the time for WCW was completely in the toilet. So I guess if I negotiated that for the Hulk, hey, you know, he must have been the cause of it, or he could always point to himself as the cause of any pay-per-view number going up with him being on it. But, you know, they gave him a huge deal, and they rolled the dice, but you know, for an old WCW fan to see the Hacksaw Duggins and to see guys like that, it was, you know, it was really disappointing. We liked Austin. We liked Pillman. We liked Foley. We liked some of these guys that were there, and to see them getting pushed out for friends of Hogan coming in who were old and slow and couldn't move, the Valentines, the Iron Sheiks, you know, the Duggins, the guys like that, it was pretty painful. Now, with that said, when the first Nitro rolled around and Lex Luger came back and showed up, That was something, because it was live, even though it was in a mall, which was kind of goofy. They had Liger and Pillman on there, but the biggest thing was firing that shot and having Lex Luger show up, which was just, you know, this was pre-newsletters, pre-internet, pre-all of that stuff. Not many people knew Luger was going to show up, and it really made an impact on me as a viewer.
We should talk about Eric Bischoff. Eric Bischoff came into the company in the, I guess it would be 93, 94. And he, of course, had worked for AWA, commentator, and that sort of thing. And they tried many different people as the head of WCW, Jim Herd, and others. And Bischoff came in. And one of the things about Eric is you watch Eric Bischoff today, and he's involved in a lot of different projects. And he does some different things in television. He does some different things he's got the whatever the what are his current projects right now? He had the midget wrestling federation. I've already forgotten the name of the thing, but
well, the Scott Baio stuff.
Scott Baio stuff, sure.
Jason Hervey, which, you know, obviously Jason Hervey, for old WCW fans, remember him linked up with Missy Hyatt, and he'd go out there with Missy and Eddie Gilbert and the Steiners back in the day in like the late '80s.
Yeah, he had a lot of different. The point I'm making here is he's got a lot of different projects, and it's obvious that in some ways, Eric Bischoff is a very intelligent guy. you know, to still be involved in the business and the entertainment business after all these years. I mean, that is a credit to him. However, on the wrestling side, I mean, we can go back to the very beginning and look at Eric Bischoff in pro wrestling and see decisions that he made that one would very much have to second guess. At the same time, he had some good ideas. And I think the key to Eric Bischoff, and I think the key to anything, is a lot of guys have good ideas. And the key is to follow up these good ideas and to really, I guess, really give these ideas your all. And I'll just give you an example right here. Eric Bischoff went to the World Wrestling Peace Festival, I believe it was called, I believe it was 1995. And he watched that show, and he was blown away. There were a lot of young high flyers. There was a lot of great wrestling. And Eric Bischoff had also, you know, he was aware of the interpromotional type of battles that were taking in place in Japan, the New Japan versus UWFI and that sort of thing. And he talked to different people around that period, and he had an idea of, man, what if we did an invasion angle here in WCW? And obviously, they had Scott Hall and Kevin Nash come in as the outsiders, and this is the beginning of their invasion angle. But the key to this is he had a great idea. He had a couple of great ideas. You know, the idea of Nitro going head-to-head with Raw. Great idea, you know. He had some ideas that were great. And a few of these, you know, he followed up on, and obviously he talked Ted Turner into putting Nitro head-to-head with Raw, and that became a gigantic success. And obviously he had the idea for an invasion angle, and he went with that, and it was a gigantic success. But I think the problem with Eric was, it's one thing to see something in action, such as an invasion angle in Japan, and decide, I'm going to do something similar with my company. It's one thing to do that, and it's another to have a deep understanding of professional wrestling and figure out how to make this thing work in the long term. And that was Eric's problem. That was the problem with the NWO, as we'll get into here in a while. The NWO was a great idea, and the NWO was really hot. But the problem was, I don't know if Eric Bischoff had a vision in his mind of where this NWO angle was going to go. And in the end, some could even argue that the NWO angle in some ways was responsible for the decline of WCW. And Eric was just he was a very interesting guy. He still is. I mean, you watch Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan and some of the things that they have approved of in TNA over the last several years, and one would question whether he knows much about wrestling at all, and certainly at the end in WCW, one would ask that question, and even during the hottest period of WCW, the hottest period of the Monday Night Wars, you could look at some of the decisions that he made, and even some of the decisions he made before there was a Monday Night War, and you really start to think, you know, was this guy right place, right time, and a few good ideas? What was Eric Bischoff? And Mike, what are your thoughts?
Hey, right place, right time, good ideas. Had a good hustle, good confidence, believed in what he was doing, and did a great job bringing in cruiserweights, bringing in, you know, obviously Glacier and Ernest Miller and Canyon and Mortis. Obviously, that didn't work out the way they had planned, but that brought a certain segment of fan. I mean, you know, whether he meant to do it or not, he started to do what WWF did in the 80s, had somebody for everybody. If you were watching, no matter who you were, you had somebody there. But with that said, he wasn't a booker, and he's not Leo Garibaldi, he's not Bill Watts, he's not. He wasn't a booker. He had ideas, they had to go through, but then the thing got too big. He never learned how to book, and it didn't matter anyway because there were too many other forces working with him and pulling and the control and just everything that happened with management and the guys that worked with him, it just spiraled out of control way too fast.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Eric Bischoff after the break. I've got more to add to this subject. And then we will jump into the beginnings of the Monday Night Wars, the first ever Raw versus Nitro battle. We'll talk about the ratings. What really began to turn around business? I know a lot of people think it was the outsiders. It actually was not. We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here for the next hour and a half talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, the history the rise and fall, the death of WCW is our topic here today. It's all we're talking about for the next 2 hours, the rise and fall of World Championship Wrestling as best we can in 2 hours, which is certainly not easy, but that's what we're going to do. So if you love this show, now's your chance. WrestlingObserver.com is the place to go. Daily news updates, daily radio shows. In fact, sometimes we have as many as 3 to 4 shows every single day. We got archives. Every show we've done dating back to 2005 is available in the archives right now. Sign up. It's $10.99. No extra fees. You sign up today, it's essentially like you signed up in 2005. Every single show we've ever done is available for you. Some of the biggest names in the history of wrestling have been on the show, including some of the biggest names in the history of the Monday Night War. Stone Cold Steve Austin has been on this show. Ric Flair has been on this show. God, the list goes on and on as far as WWF and WCW guys during that period. But check them out. Head into the archives. You can search for a particular superstar's name. And Diamond Dallas Page, for example, has been on the show a million times talking many wacky WCW stories. Lance Storm, who, of course, had a big run there at the end, has been on the program countless times as well. Pretty much every other Thursday, he's on the show. All of these are available with your subscription. Again, if you love this show, I guarantee you will love a subscription to WrestlingObserver.com. So head up there and check it out. WrestlingObserver.com, $10.99 per month. You will not regret it. And if you do, you can email me and we'll make it right. But I don't think you have much to worry about. You will have a good time. All right, Mike, let's get into this here. I wanted to mention one more thing about Eric Bischoff. In some ways, he reminded me a little bit of Vince Russo in the sense that Russo, many times, including during the Monday Night Wars, would do a rewrite show where he'd have a whole bunch of big angles taking place. Everything would start over again fresh, and it'd be a great show. And then it's the follow-up that killed him. And I think that was part of the problem with Eric Bischoff in the sense that, yes, he had a lot of good ideas, such as the Outsiders, but how did he follow up on these ideas? How did he follow up on the idea of having a bunch of great cruiserweight matches on the on Nitro? Did he follow that up by elevating certain people? Well, actually, he did not. That's one of the main reasons that as time wore on, people began to get frustrated. Eric had this idea that, I think he had this idea that whatever was happening during the peak would remain like that forever. In other words, I think he had this idea that Hulk Hogan is making a lot of money now. In fact, he always said this, where goes Hogan, goes the money. Meaning Hulk Hogan made a lot of money for the company in the mid-90s, and he figured if he just kept going with Hogan, Hogan would always be making money. You know, he didn't have that larger outlook and that ability to look into different wrestling territories or look back on the history of wrestling and see, how long did this person draw for? If this person drew for a long time, why? Was it different, you know, was he sent out of the territory for a while? Did he come back? Did he have different challengers? What was the world of wrestling like in the period as compared to today? You know, was there weekly television with main event matches on every single night? And you know, some of this also was the fact that it was nothing to look back on. You know, at the time, Nitro was revolutionary because we were getting main event matches for free on TV every single week. And that's one of the reasons that people were tuning into the shows. And he just had an inability to follow up on a lot of different great ideas he had. And what that meant was he had a lot of ideas that made a lot of money at first. And then as time wore on, they stopped making money, and he didn't make the changes needed to fix these problems.
Well, you know, when you're making the amount of money that they were making, it was really easy to turn a blind eye. Actually, you know what? It really was not that easy to turn a blind eye to what was going on. It was amazing that they did, and it was amazing that they made so much money in spite of themselves. When it came to house shows, I mean, you got people on TV. The one big thing with WWF was, those guys you saw on TV, they're going to be coming to your town. When it came to that in house shows that were doing big business, guys wouldn't show up. Guys who had the ability to have creative control in their contracts, being able to pull that card at any time and doing it unprofessionally and him having to deal with it and not knowing how to deal with it in the old school wrestling fashion. So getting upset and freaking out and just the amount of a mess that was going on, even if everything was going perfectly, again, there were so many other things along with that were working against him that even if he had his ducks in a row and he had a storyline that was going to go, there were going to be guys dropping in and out of it and making it hell just because they wouldn't let it happen because they had the ability to pull rank on the company, and everyone, the inmates ran the asylum.
1995, September 4th, 1995, to be exact, was the first Raw versus Nitro battle. And as noted, nearly everybody thought this was going to be a disaster. Everybody thought that the Monday night wrestling audience would be split. You know, if Raw was doing, I don't know, 3 million viewers, 4 million viewers, everybody figured Raw would now be doing 2 and Nitro would be doing 2. And fans would pick and choose. What actually happened was WCW Saturday Night, which was doing far better ratings than I think a lot of people remember at the time. It appears that a lot of the people that were watching WCW Saturday Night tuned in and watched WCW Monday Nitro, a one-hour show head-to-head with Raw, or actually it was a one-hour show taking place. Was it head-to-head? I actually have to look back on this. I don't have my book in front of me, believe it or not.
I don't think it was, because I think Nitro was on earlier. I think it was on at 8 to 9, or 7 to 8, actually.
Sure. This would be an important detail, by the way, that we might have to check out here. But regardless, the very first Raw Nitro Monday Night War on September 4th saw Nitro beat Raw, a 2.5 to a 2.2 rating. Nitro actually won the night, and as noted, the audience was not split. A brand new audience, I think a lot of people believe, appeared out of nowhere. But in fact, I believe it was much of the WCW Saturday Night audience that showed up on Monday night.
I was one of those people.
Yep. To watch,
you know, because I was not used to wrestling on Monday night. I was historically Saturday, you know, all day wrestling guy. And there was always some on during the week, but it was when they came up with Monday Night Raw, it was still tough to get used to. And again, I was still in high school at the time, so I had school that night. There was Monday Night Football on. There were other things, you know, social things and things like that because of my age that I was out there where, you know, to be honest, I didn't really watch Raw. I'd watch All American and some of the stuff that was on the weekends, but I just would never really watch Raw. And my really first experience on a Monday night ended up being Nitro just because it was going to be on Monday night.
So that was the first ever show, and of course, one of the biggest things people remember from that show was the fact that Lex Luger jumped ship from WWF and appeared on Nitro. He'd worked a WWF house show the night before, and unbeknownst to nearly everybody, he showed up as a complete surprise on Nitro. And one of the important things that... Again, I don't know if Eric Bischoff ever fully understood this, and I don't think he does based on his run on Impact, but one of the keys to the success of Nitro was the fact that they used a bunch of guys that were big stars in the 80s, the Hulk Hogans, the Ric Flairs, the Randy Savages. They used a bunch of guys that had been stars with WCW before, but had moved to WWF. A guy like Lex Luger, for example, since we just mentioned his name, that maybe weren't top of the card at that point in WWF. In fact, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall in particular. You know, Kevin Nash at least had been the WWF champion. Scott Hall had not. But the key to this is that when you're doing an interpromotional war, when you're doing a promotion versus promotion battle, or even, you know, jumping, let's just say that Impact was significantly more popular than it is right now, jumping from one promotion to another that are on close to equal footing, you know, the key to this is having a brand new place to work is like a fresh slate for a person. And a lot of people thought, oh my God, WCW is using Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair and Randy Savage, all of these old guys. And of course, at the time, people considered them old. You know, Hulk Hogan and Sting and Ric Flair, you know, still working in WCW today, and they're significantly older. You know, at the time, they were much, much younger. But the point is, these were guys that a lot of fans that were in their teens, when these fans were little kids, they saw Hulk Hogan and they saw Randy Savage and they saw Ric Flair, and they grew up with these guys from the 80s. And their interest in wrestling, as often happens with children, probably waned. And maybe they left wrestling for several years. They went through middle school, then they got into high school. And one night they turned on the TV and, oh my God, there's Hulk Hogan. There's Randy Savage. These guys are main eventers again. You know, Hulk Hogan wasn't, he hadn't disappeared from the scene. You know, Randy Savage wasn't a commentator like he'd been for quite a while in WWE. And you know, these were guys that it was like, wow, you know, this is our second chance to get into wrestling. And to a lot of these fans, these guys, to them, were new again. You know, they weren't seen as old guys that, you know, Hogan had a lot of problems. And, you know, Hogan had even headlined pay-per-views in WCW, but it was during the dark ages of WCW in a sense. And I think a lot of the fans that that came along during the Monday Night Wars hadn't seen any of that stuff. So all of this stuff was brand new to them. And it was a huge success at the beginning. But like with anything, with any sort of nostalgia, when nostalgia hits, it has a short shelf life, and you've got to create new stars, and that was the problem. But when you turned on that Nitro for the first time, and you saw Hulk Hogan, and you saw these stars that you grew up with you when you were a little kid, and oh my God, Lex Luger just walked onto the show, and you know the announcers are talking about how he'd just been seen in WWF or whatever. I mean, this is a big deal for people, even though to maybe somebody who had been following wrestling very closely, it was like, wow, we're going to see a show filled with Hulk Hogan's and Randy Savage's and Ric Flair's here in 1995. It's very different for your average fan.
Well, the whole thing, it was a blowaway thing because, yeah, I mean, it's like anything that rises and falls. You know, the boom in the 50s and then it dropped again. And, you know, although wrestling wasn't as big on TV in the 70s in a lot of ways, the attendance was always big and then, you know, it drops again. And just there's ebbs and flows to everything. And a lot of people, when they stopped watching the steroid era, the Hogan on Arsenio, you know, Vince on Donahue, after that, they got burned out, they grew up, they had other things to do, they got tired, there were things to move on to. And the boom was over, and it was the first time that they had seen those guys and probably had seen wrestling since that time. And when they're seeing it now, they're seeing it in a mall. Wrestling's in a mall. And you got Jushin Liger and Brian Pillman doing these moves that, you know, you sort of may have seen it on the old Coliseum videotape when they had, like, the Cobra and Tiger Mask on there, but that's not what these guys were doing. And then Lex Luger, who was familiar, and wait, I thought I had heard he worked in WWF, and there he is. And, yeah, it was just, it was completely fresh, new, different, and I, you know, again, as an older fan, it was kind of disconcerting of, like, God, what, especially a WCW fan, what are they doing? But in hindsight, it was the thing to do because it was fresh, new, and different.
Of course, the other thing we talked about earlier was the decision to put main event matches on free television. Prior to that point, wrestling television had been very different. It's very similar to what I was talking about earlier in the sense that, you know, sometimes you can go back and you can look in history and you can go, okay, well, you know, they, you know, this is what happened in this territory or this promotion during a time very similar to what we're doing right now, and this was the end result. But this was like, this was breaking new ground in some ways. Obviously, you know, different territories had done deals where they had main event matches and that sort of thing on television. But as far as like on a national level here, you know, Raw for so many years, I mean, you maybe had a main event match. We had a lot of squash matches underneath and that sort of thing. And Eric Bischoff changed that entire formula. And ironically, that formula is still in effect today. And we're going to talk about why that's ironic when we come back here from the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live, talking the history of WCW here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here for the next hour, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. The history of WCW is our topic here today, and something I was talking about before the break, wanted to touch on briefly here, the irony of the fact that Eric Bischoff changed wrestling television, and in some ways he changed it for the better, in some ways he changed it for the worse, but it's kind of funny nowadays when you argue with people about, for example, the value of squash matches, and And, of course, there aren't a lot of squash matches on television nowadays. And the reason for that was during the Monday Night Wars, there was concern that if a squash match was put on television, fans would switch to the other channel. And, of course, nowadays, you talk to people about squash matches, and they're like, oh, you just can't do squash matches anymore. And the question is, why? You know, it's not like there's another wrestling show on the other channel going head-to-head that if you put a squash match on television, people are going to switch channels. The game has changed. You know, obviously, you don't want a show full of squash matches or that sort of thing. But a squash match every now and then, I think, is great for getting over a character, getting over his finisher, getting over his big moves. And we don't see that anymore, and it's based on concern from a decade, 15 years ago, and circumstances that no longer exist.
That's the whole thing, Brian. Guys don't have their roles defined to them. I mean, some guys have to get squashed here and there. I mean, that's what their job is. And just, I don't know, it's very frustrating because you can have a great main event match every single TV show. The thing is, build up to that main event match throughout the show and have the characters have, you know, to be clearly defined, to have a role, to for people to know what they are and what they're about and what they're going for and where they've been. That's what you have to do, and that was the other thing they got passed over so much in the Monday Night War era, especially on WCW's side. It was, here these guys are, take them or leave them, and people started to leave them, and the characters themselves started to leave.
All right, we're going to head to a break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking this subject, the history of WCW, the rise and fall. Talk about some memories of one of the hottest periods in the history of American professional wrestling, a period that arguably was the best and worst thing ever to happen to big-time pro wrestling. Coming up more after the break, you're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We're here for the next hour talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. Today's topic, the rise and fall of WCW, the death of WCW. We're going to try and cram as much as we can into 2 hours. Should be a fun time. We spent the first hour talking about the beginnings of the Monday Night Wars. And I want to make sure that we get this clarification out there because I did a little bit of research during our hourly break. And in fact, the original chart that I was looking at as I recapped the show was incorrect. What actually happened on September 4th, 1995, Nitro did a 2.9 rating. The debut episode of Nitro was unopposed. Raw was preempted. So Nitro did a 2.9 all by itself. And the very next week was the first head-to-head battle, September 11th, 1995. And in the very first head-to-head battle, Nitro did, in fact, win the war as well, 2.5 to 2.2. The very next week, September 18th, Raw won 2.5 to 2.4. And in week four, in the third week opposing each other, Nitro did a 2.7 and Raw did a 1.9, at which point the battle was on and largely went back and forth for quite a while until, of course, the epic 84-week win streak on the part of WCW. Just wanted to clarify that there. It's funny looking back, how long is it now? Nearly 20 years since that first Nitro. And trying to remember, I know, Mike, your memory was kind of weird because you remember daylight, of all things, during that first episode of Impact. Or, I'm sorry, Nitro. I may make that mistake several times on this show here today. That first episode of Nitro. But that apparently is what happened. September, the very first show unopposed. The next week, Nitro won.
Yeah, you know, you couldn't really. I know that there were wacky time issues during that time too, and it was always funny as, you know, Nitro grew into this monster with a replay overnight and 3-hour shows and all this madness that, you know, how it started the way it did. It was just amazing what kind of creature it turned into.
We're going to head to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Outsiders. Talk about the Outsiders, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. Coming up after the break, Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by the great Michael P. Sempervivi, also here on WrestlingObserver.com. We are talking the rise and fall and death of WCW, and it is time to talk about the Outsiders. Mike, what were your thoughts the first time you saw Scott Hall walk out on Nitro?
It was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. Now, I had known enough to know that he was not, you know, a WWF contracted guy. But almost everyone else I know didn't know that. Most people didn't know that. And it didn't matter in the fact that I knew that. The only thing I knew was it was the coolest way I had seen in a long, long time to introduce somebody. It was Mike Enos and somebody. Mike Enos was with Colonel Rob Parker. He was wrestling somebody. Just one of those goofy Nitro matches, which was awful, too. And that was another bad thing about Nitro that took place. They always had meaningless guys doing meaningless things. Guys with no direction in random matches that would take place, and it would drive you nuts. But then out came Scott Hall. And Scott Hall comes out there, and you know who I am, and I'm declaring war, because WWF was running those skits of the Nacho Man and the Huckster and Billionaire Ted and all that sort of nonsense in a juvenile way to get back at the guys that were going down there, and the fact that they were having competition. And WCW, I mean, just the fact that they were taking these older guys, you know, took hits from a lot of people, that they were trying to rehash the past, you know. And then, you know, but Hall goes out there and says that, and it was like, it was just the coolest way I'd seen in a long time to introduce somebody, and it was kind of amazing, and it was like, wow, he had the accent. It was Razor Ramon has rolled into WCW.
And a lot of people remember this as the beginning of the big turnaround, and in many ways it was, but the first signs of a WCW turnaround were actually at the house shows with the Ric Flair-Randy Savage feud, which I remember them having some great matches. I unfortunately never got to see them in an actual house show. Nitro didn't come out to the Seattle area all that often, but they had some matches on the house shows that really boosted business, and that, in addition to just the momentum that they had with Nitro, and the beginning of this outsiders angle, really started to get people noticing WCW. And again, like I said, this was a generation of fans, I believe, that grew up watching a lot of these guys as children. And they were older, you know, granted Hogan and Savage and Sting and Ric Flair. You know, these guys were all a little bit older. You know, they were in their 40s. But at the time, 40 was old for wrestling. You know, now obviously you see some of these guys in wrestling today, especially on Impact. Some real old guys. But, you know, at the time, 40 was old, but as it turned out, 40 really wasn't that old. I've mentioned this many times in terms of creating stars, and you see it now, a big problem in WWF today, WWE, based on, trying to get new talent over. You know, there was a time where the statement was always, you need new young talent. You know, you need new young talent, blah, 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 young talent, young talent, young talent. And as it turns out, at least in my belief, it's not young talent, it's just fresh talent. You know, it's a guy that has not been on your TV for a long time. You know, granted, these guys I'm talking about here were older, but to the people that were getting into this Monday Night War and they heard about it from their friends and maybe they were WWF fans and they decided to tune in one week and thought, man, you know, Nitro is different. It's edgy. It seems more hip than this WWF with this new generation and these dinosaurs and these cartoon characters here, TL Hopper and whatever else we had in WWF at the time. And they saw these guys here and yes, some of them were older, but they were brand new again for these people. And, that was kind of the problem in WCW. It was not so much that the age of the particular individuals, but the fact that people kept seeing the same people over and over and over again for years. That was the problem. Not so much that a Juventud Guerrera was not brought up and built up and made into a big star, but the fact that a new face, a new star, somebody new was getting over. You know, that started to happen with WWE in the mid-90s. New faces, new stars started to get over. And it wasn't like Bill Goldberg was 18 years old when he debuted and took the wrestling world by storm. He was just new. And the problem with WWE today is, yeah, a lot of these guys are young. You know, John Morrison is very young, for example. But when you think of John Morrison, people have seen him in the mid-card forever. And it's hard to get a guy over like that when they've seen him in that position for so long. And that was a problem with WCW. Actually, what I'll say is that was what made WCW a success in the beginning, and then long-term ended up being a problem for them.
Well, that was the whole thing, was they got guys, and I mean, look at how that roster was. All the guys from Mexico had been working for a long time. Jericho and Storm and Eddie Guerrero and Malenko, and those guys had been working for a long time. Hogan, all of the superstars. I mean, that was a roster chock full of experienced guys, a lot of them from all over the place. And WCW, when it was at its best, Nitro gave you the 31 flavors. There was a little bit for everyone on the show, and when it was humming, it was awesome. The problem was everyone rested back on their laurels, and again, because of politics and other things, they positioned themselves in ways that affected how other people looked and all that stuff. And while that was going on, WWF didn't have any choice, you know, the way WCW was throwing around money and being able to keep guys where they had to make a dramatic change and they had to create characters. And obviously there was a little bit of luck, there was a little bit of skill, there was a little bit of everything involved, but they worked hard to build characters, and that's their biggest problem as it stands now. They're not developing guys for long enough. There is no place for them to really work. There is, but WWF doesn't want to actually go out of their way to send them anywhere, and they're not developing these guys. They call them up too early. They blow them up. They beat them up. They're completely useless, and then they go out with the trash again. That's why they only have a few stars right now, and it's kind of scary for the future because you look at exactly what WCW did, and it's a different situation, but as far as the talent of the pro wrestlers go, it's kind of be the same thing.
The big turning point for the Outsiders angle, of course, was the famous 1996 Bash at the Beach pay-per-view. And as a trivia note, I was at the 1995 Bash at the Beach, and I drove from Seattle to Huntington Beach, California, which was a 24-hour drive, which we did nonstop because we were 19 and completely out of our minds. And we got down there for Bash at the Beach, and I had flyers for this new project I had started, the Figure 4 Wrestling Newsletter, which I had been publishing for 1 month. And, in fact, at the 1995 Bash at the Beach, I believe in Huntington Beach, California, myself, Dave Meltzer, and Wade Keller were all on the beach together at the same time. And I think I actually gave a flyer to Wade, if I recall correctly. I didn't even know it at the time. I learned this years later. But that was the first big WCW event that I went to. Obviously, out here in Seattle, as I noted, we didn't get a lot of WCW shows. But I drove down for that one, and I covered it, and that was pretty much the beginning for this newsletter. But 1 year later, at Bash at the Beach 1996, we had the big Hulk Hogan heel turn. And the Hogan heel turn was interesting because it was tough. It was tough talking to Hogan about doing this heel turn. You got to remember that Hulk Hogan, you know, Hulk Hogan had been babyface Hulk Hogan forever. It was not 2011 where especially on Impact, for example, guys, you know, Mr. Anderson a while back there switched from babyface to heel like 3 times in a month or something like that. This was not that period. No, Hulk Hogan, you know, he debuted with WWF on a national stage as a babyface, and he was a babyface all through the 80s, all through the rise and fall of Hulkamania, all through the 90s, left WWF, went to WCW, was a huge babyface, and this was a big deal. This was a big deal, whether or not to make that jump and turn him heel. And there had been so many people talking about who the mystery third member of the Outsiders was going to be. And I think most people at the time, those of us that were on the inside, were pretty much well aware it was going to be Hogan. But a lot of fans were unaware. And Hulk Hogan came down the aisle, and of course he turned on the baby faces and did the big leg drop and the promo talking about how this was the new world order of wrestling. And people were pelting the ring with garbage. And, you know, for those that saw it, they'll never forget it. It was a huge deal, and that was the beginning of the meteoric rise for the NWO in pro wrestling.
Yeah, Tony Schiavone signing off the broadcast, and Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell. You know, there were signs of this.
We have to actually head to a break. We'll be right back, everybody. Overshot my target. Observer Live, Sports Byline, Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. I was so excited by that last segment that I overshot my target. But we are back. Let's do a little bit of a shorter segment here. We're talking the history of WCW, the rise and fall of WCW, the death of WCW. Very exciting topic here, as you would expect. Here with Mike Sempervivi of the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare at WrestlingObserver.com. We're talking the Hulk Hogan heel turn at Bash at the Beach. Mike, you were saying before I rudely cut you off after I rudely overshot my target.
No, you know, I was saying there were little signs of this with Hogan. They did the thing in all black on Nitro. You know, he shaved and it did some things where, you know, there were signs that it was going to be him. But the reaction afterward was just, I mean, that crowd could not have, obviously it was real emotion and it was absolutely unbelievable how well that thing was actually able to come off. It was really something else, and even though, you know, I wasn't the biggest Hulk Hogan fan in the world, and, you know, obviously being an old Flair fan, it was like, ah, God, are we going to have to see, you know, the Hall and Nash? How is this really going to work? I liked Hall in the WWF. I didn't really like Nash, but you just had to get sucked right into it because it was new, it was fresh, and it was so out of control, and the real emotion was really the thing. I mean, even, you know, being a smart fan, getting caught up a little bit in the fact that, like, when the NWO would just go out there and wreck shop on guys, and it was just like you got to the point where, you know, you started to work yourself of just, you know, it's like, God, well, when is this going to end? But you still watch it every week, and you were into it, and it was like, God, they got me. You know, they drew you in, and that was a big problem. That machine of the NWO never stopped going and just kept mauling people, and WCW never got their comeuppance, but, you know, going to the Great American Bash that year and Hall and Nash powerbombing Bischoff through the table, and there was the Kevin Sullivan, Chris Benoit, Falls Count Anywhere match, and there was a lot of really good stuff on there. Again, it shows that no boom period. There's no such thing as an overnight success. There's no such thing as one thing making all of the change in the world. I guess there is, but it happens very rarely. It's good timing and a good combination of things and smart things going on all at the same time that create the spark and end up blowing up bigger.
You know what's ironic, looking back, is comparisons between the NWO angle and the WCW invasion of WWF after WWF bought the company. What's funny about the whole thing is that an invasion angle is a very simple story to tell. It's exactly like a wrestling match. You know, maybe there's an early rally by the babyfaces, but then the heels get the heat. And the heels go to work on the babyfaces, and they destroy them for a long time. And then the babyfaces make their big rally, and if it's the end of the feud, the babyface goes over in the end. Everybody's happy. Same thing with an invasion angle, you know. With an invasion angle, I mean, me personally, I would not have the babyface rally at the very beginning, unless it's just a small battle, and then the heels come in with the big guns and successfully invade. But to do an invasion angle, you've got to get heat on the invaders. The invaders have to get their heat. The invaders have to destroy the babyfaces for a long period of time. And then, of course, the babyfaces make their big comeback, and they successfully run off the invaders, and then you can do whatever you want at that point. The invaders, you know, you take some prisoners, or the invaders come over and, you know, you absorb them into your promotion or whatever the case might be. It should be simple, but it's, of course, never is. The interesting thing is the NWO invasion, so to speak, and the WCW invasion of WWF after WWF bought the company, they were the polar opposites. You know, with the NWO invasion, Eric Bischoff had a great idea. Let's do an interpromotional invasion angle. Great idea! You know, more people should have done that angle over the years, because it's a huge success. But there's a problem when you do that sort of angle. You've got to get heat, and then in the end, the baby faces have to be victorious. And the problem with the NWO angle was the bad guys destroyed the good guys over and over and over and over and over again. And they destroyed them, and they destroyed them. And every now and then a babyface would get a win, but then the NWO would destroy them, and destroy them, and destroy them. And fans never got that big comeback. They never got the big win in the end by WCW. What happened was year after year, they were told by the NWO that, what, Mike?
Well, they were told by the NWO what?
That WCW sucks.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Who did you come here to see? Did you come here to see WCW or the NWO? And, of course, the cool guy said it. It was the NWO, and it was amazing. You know, it's very amazing in wrestling with something so simple as that invasion angle that they could never pull it off. I mean, WCW, the NWA at the time, had a chance to do this when they bought the UWF, and in one night wiped everyone out. But at least when they did that, when they had Steve Williams lose, when they had Terry Taylor get killed by Nikita Koloff, and when they had all these guys come in and say, none of you are anything, except for Sting. Sting, we're going to have you with Ric Flair, but the rest of you are garbage. Even though you bought the company, it's yours. There's no reason to treat it like that. You know, at least those guys had a chance to rebuild themselves. When it came to WCW, week after week after week, they got killed and beaten down. And I went to Starrcade in 1997. That was going to be WCW's big redemption day. That was Sting and Hogan and Bret Hart. And all of these wrestlers were in the crowd, and they were all celebrating at the end of the night, and it was just how phony and how pathetic is this, that this is the best they could do after getting beaten up by these guys so long. And then the next night happened where the NWO and that side conquered again. And again, it was like, what are you doing?
WCW sucks, we were told year after year after year. And WCW never didn't suck. You know, WCW never vanquished the NWO. They never proved that, in fact, guess what? We don't suck. We're winners. WCW became a promotion where it was cool to think they sucked. And then, as years went by and they began to really suck, it got even worse. It was almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. And contrast that, the exact opposite, when WWF bought WCW. I mean, these invaders, as I wrote in the book, this was the worst invasion in the history of warfare. It was not even an invasion. You know, Lance Storm ran in and hit a super kick. And that was like the beginning of the end for this invasion. It was all downhill from there. You know, the invaders never got heat on WWF. You know, you can, I don't have the book in front of me, but you can look at the stats. You know, you look at, in their biggest year, WCW grossing $225 million. And you look at the WWF and WCW feud after WWF bought the company. And that big invasion pay-per-view that did, 775,000 buys or something like that. 775,000 domestic buys. That's more than WrestleMania the last couple of years. 775,000 domestic buys. The biggest non-WrestleMania wrestling pay-per-view of all time was that Invasion pay-per-view. WWF versus WCW, which wasn't even really WWF versus WCW. It was fake. They had WWF guys on the WCW side. You know, they didn't have Goldberg, they didn't have Sting, they didn't have any of these huge stars. Still did 775,000 buys. And if you fast forward August, September, October, November, 4 months from that Invasion pay-per-view to the final blow-off Survivor Series pay-per-view that ended that feud supposedly forever, and you look at the business that Survivor Series did, this was the worst invasion of all time. The worst invasion of all time. So it was like two completely different things. They both had the same end goal in mind, which was to make money, but the NWO went too far, and the babyfaces never got the win, and the WWF invasion went too far the other way. The heels never got heat. So they both failed in a monumental fashion, long term.
Just a weird psychological thing that takes place with both of those things, because you own both of those things. Why are you doing this? And you own, if you own them both, there's no reason to do that. There is no, that guy's better than me. That, it just, that era of wrestling had been far, far, far over with. But it showed also what that era had made these guys as far as ego goes and as far as the ability to have their sway. because of, you know, the way contracts were structured and because of the way that the deals had to be done because of the back and forth between the groups, it created, in a way, this type of monster for the management of the company.
The NWO invasion here, as we didn't note in the book, and many people talked about it. You know, it's one thing. Actually, I was going to say it's one thing if the good guys don't win the war in the end. That's actually the entire thing. But the worst thing about the NWO invasion was, as hot as it was, ultimately they watered it down by throwing everybody in it. You know, at first we had the NWO black and white, where just any goofball ended up as part of the NWO, which watered down the entire thing. Then you had another split off into the NWO Wolfpack, and, you know, it was at its best when you had the three guys, the three invaders that were running wild. But at the same time, in some ways, that was also the worst part of the NWO, because how many times did we see three guys beat up eight guys from WCW, making the WCW guys look like complete and total geeks, you know? And furthermore, making the NWO guys look like even bigger superheroes. They were in there beating up eight men, all by the three of them. So it was very, you know, when you look back, the history of WCW is the history of the best and worst of everything. You know, the some of the best strengths of the NWO ended up being some of the biggest weaknesses of the NWO. And it's very ironic to look back and see how these things went. We actually have to do a break a little early this time, but we'll be back in just a moment with a much longer segment, Wrestling Observer Live, here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here for the next 20 minutes talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. For the latest news and information in pro wrestling and MMA, head to WrestlingObserver.com. We don't have time here for a full plug. All you need to know is if you love this show and you only get to hear it one time per week, you are missing out. Sign up today at WrestlingObserver.com. It's $10.99 a month. That's it. You can try it for 1 month. If you don't like it, you never have to sign up again, but give it a try. $10.99. If you like this show, you will love a subscription because we do shows every single day. And if the rare day comes that we don't do a show, we have every single show we have ever recorded dating back to 2005 available in the archives right now. You will perhaps never, ever run out of audio if you sign up today. It's $10.99. That covers everything, all of the new shows, all of the archives, and everything else we have to offer. Head up to WrestlingObserver.com. Scroll down the right-hand side of the page, a list of our latest four free radio shows. Download them. If you like what you hear, that's what you could be getting every day. In fact, we have days where four shows just like that are posted on a single day. So check it out, WrestlingObserver.com. You like this show, you'll love the site, so check it out. We are talking the history of WCW. As I predicted, there's no way we're going to get through all of this. There's no way we can do the death of WCW and the history of WCW justice in a two-hour show, but we are doing our best. We would be remiss if we did not talk about Goldberg, the biggest star that WCW ever created. He came from nothing. It was the easiest storyline of all time. You get a guy who is big, you get a guy who is intimidating, you get a guy who is believable, and you have him beat everyone. And you get money. And then they screwed it all up. Tell us about Goldberg, Mike.
Yeah, it was, you know, they had this guy, and for people that were big WCW fans that were watching that whole time, you had Steve McMichael was still part of the Horsemen, or what was left of the Horsemen, as the NWO was certainly taking care of them as one of their first missions of destroying Ric Flair, which they did over and over and over again. But Steve McMichael had been wrestling Bill Goldberg, and the battle was over the fact that Steve McMichael had a Super Bowl ring and Bill Goldberg didn't with the Falcons. Well, they were going to have a pay-per-view match where McMichael, I assume, was going to go over because they decided to change their plans, and instead Goldberg was laid out with a lead pipe in the back. Match never happened. A few months later, this guy comes out there, and he's big, he's strong, he looks, you know, just this aura about him where it's like this isn't your average newcomer or new wacky character with generic music that they had in WCW, and there were a lot of those guys on Nitro. He came to the ring, he wrestled Hugh Morris, he beat the crap out of him, jackhammered him, which was a move that people hadn't really seen at the time, especially done in the way that he had did it, and then looked at the camera and said, that's one. It was like, okay, now I wonder if they're actually going to, you know, go on with this or what's going to happen. But then he came out the next week and he just kept destroying guys over and over again with the same moves, establishing his spear, the jackhammer, his coming out and his growls, and the fact that he didn't do interviews. Mean Gene would try to interview him, he'd walk right past him. He didn't have time for that. He was just a destroyer. People looked at him as, well, maybe he was their answer to Steve Austin and trying to compare him, but realistically, he wasn't. Yeah, he was bald, and yeah, he wore black tights, but it was actually just a different kind of aura. He was WCW's greatest creation that they had made, and then they didn't know what to do with him as it continued to go on. Yeah, they gave him the streak and everything, but, you know, obviously the way it had ended with Kevin Nash and Scott Hall and hitting him with the taser, you know, it was interesting to see where they were going to go with that anyway, because at some point they were going to have to lose, and they had done so many dumb things throughout the whole thing, but he was so successful it didn't matter. They gave away Hogan and him at the Georgia Dome and for 70,000 people, and luckily they weren't able to miss a beat on that, even though they blew it as far as the pay-per-view goes. Things were going that well where things like that actually didn't really affect them. It affected them long term, but that's how strong they were going, that they were able to blow through it, and that's how hot he was. He destroyed everyone, he kept mowing down everyone, and he kept going along. But, you know, I guess we'll never know how it would have really ended if it wasn't for the way they did things at Starrcade and how they treated him immediately after that. But I don't know. It's just, I wonder what would have happened if, what would you have done for Goldberg? Would you have kept the streak going forever, or how would you have had him lose?
I would have had him lose to a rising star. I mean, they did everything wrong. You know, when people talk about why did WCW die, which we should probably address here before this program is over, it's much simpler than a lot of people like to try to explain. What happened was they did everything wrong, and meanwhile, on the other channel, WWF did everything right. And what do I mean by that? Was WWE doing perfect shows every week? No. Was WCW doing the worst shows ever every week? No. But WWF was in the middle of a period where they were actually creating stars, unlike how they don't create stars today. They were creating new stars. They were getting new guys over. The rise of Steve Austin, the rise of The Rock, the rise of Triple H, of all people, the rise of Mick Foley, Rock, Austin, Foley, Michaels, Undertaker, you know, Bret Hart before he jumped to WCW. WWF was doing these things right. WCW, meanwhile, was not creating stars. It was these same guys on top doing the same matches and getting older and older and older, not just in age, but in television years. You know, we'd seen these guys doing the same matches. We'd seen these same guys running the promotion forever. And Vince Russo, to me, was the real beginning of the end for this company. When he jumped ship from WWF and he started booking some of the worst television that I've ever seen in my life. And the ratings did not, he claims the ratings went up. The ratings were essentially stagnant during his first run, and you know, it didn't matter. The bottom line is it didn't matter because it was business, and regardless of whether the ratings went up, down, or stayed the same, and as noted, they largely stayed the same and then began to drop. You know, the issue was that, all of that aside, their pay-per-view business collapsed. Absolutely collapsed. And it was this intense battle to keep ratings high. And meanwhile, all of their other revenue streams died. And Kevin Nash and others like to talk about this AOL Time Warner merger. You know, this was the real reason that WCW died. And aside from the obvious issues of... what was I talking about there? I just got an email right in the middle of that speech. Aside from the obvious issues of the business collapsing and that sort of thing, and the obvious issues of Nash claiming the AOL Time Warner merger was the problem when his timeline doesn't even match up, the bottom line is this. AOL Time Warner did, in fact, get Ted Turner out of power. That is true. However, AOL Time Warner, when they were looking at the books, if WCW would have been making $225 million a year, like they were making during the period that they were at their peak, I would say, and there's no way to prove this, obviously, but I could probably tell you with a fair amount of certainty that WCW would not have died. The issue was that WCW, through their horrible booking and through their complete destruction of all of their revenue streams, they created a situation where they were losing approximately $65 million a year. So, when Time Warner looked at those books, they did not see a wrestling company that was grossing $225 million a year. They saw a wrestling company that had God knows how many lawsuits out against it. It was considered a joke by a lot of people. The ratings were down. And above all else, they were losing $65 million. This was the easiest thing in the world. The easiest decision to make. Axe the company. So Kevin Nash and everybody else can talk about AOL, Time Warner, all they want. But the reality is, booking by Kevin Nash and Vince Russo and others resulted in the company losing so much money that it didn't matter if AOL, Time Warner, or Bank of America, or whoever else owned WCW, when that person looked at those books, this promotion was done.
And it's one thing, in business, it's okay to have a loss leader. But that's how bad WCW was hemorrhaging money, where it still got ratings for cable. It still got good ratings, but they got rid of it because it was losing that much money. And that, again, is not something that happened overnight. It happened, though, in the span of only, what, 2 years? It was incredibly embarrassing. And one of the things you talked about with WWF, you watched them, you know, establishing stars and building stars. As Scott Steiner once said in a rambling, terrible promo during the dying days of WCW, he did say something very telling. All of those guys up there who are stars were all here except for one, meaning The Rock.
That is true, but at the same time, there's no reason that the WCW could not have created stars. You know,
no, they instead took a bunch of guys out of the power plant that weren't ready and tried to dress them up and throw them out there to replicate the success of Goldberg, or to try to replicate a wacky character that Vince, you know, Russo worked in the WWF, even though Vince McMahon was the one who had the final call to actually temper Vince Russo's, all of his goofy ideas, him and Ed Ferrara, and was actually able to put on a tolerable show. They had UPW, they had Heartland, they had Ohio Valley. They had their antlers out there and Dory Funk, and they used these guys to develop stars, whereas WCW had the power plant and Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker, an antiquated system in training wrestlers, and really no vision.
You know, it's more than that, though. I mean, to be completely fair, I don't know who this is fair to, but this is just a fair statement. You know, WWF had a great 5-year period. Like, as far as creating megastars, they never had a better 3-4 year period than that period right there. And I don't know if it was just right people, right place, right time. I don't know if it was just the peak of Vince McMahon's creative abilities. I don't know if just like a lot of very lucky things happened to them. But you know, it's kind of funny because I don't want to downplay WWE winning the war, but the fact of the matter is, from following WWE for the last decade now, and seeing how they operate with no competition whatsoever, I mean, obviously, Vince McMahon works better when he's got strong competition. I mean, that's a given. But seeing how he operates with no competition and nothing to lose, and looking at the number of stars that he's created over the last decade, real big, absolute, gigantic megastars. I mean, John Cena's it, and he's not at the level of Rock or Steve Austin. I would think, as far as drawing, probably during that period, I mean, guys like Triple H were probably drawing, well, I don't know, that's a tough one, as far as merchandise and everything. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the WWE's win was a combination of WCW doing a lot of really stupid things that they could have prevented, and WWE having a lot of great things happen to them that not necessarily were things they could replicate, as we have seen over the last decade. Meaning, I think a lot of it was right place, right time. For guys like Steve Austin and The Rock and Mick Foley and the way all of this worked out with Bret Hart and Vince McMahon and Survivor Series, and how Vince McMahon, he was never supposed to be a heel character, but it grew organically over a real life situation. And again, I don't want to downplay WWE's victory, But it was not a situation of WWF just, you know, being heads and, you know, head over heels better than WCW. You know, a lot of great things happened with WWE. They did do a lot of smart things. But at the same time, they were also facing an enemy that had absolutely no idea what they were doing and screwed everything up.
WCW died, ECW died, All Japan almost died, NOAH was created. Things happened at that time. It was an amazing time. It was absolutely, again, with how things went with wrestling, it wasn't the best, but it was just an amazing time to actually live through and watch everything that happened.
We're going to head to a break. When we come up, we're going to wrap this up. The story of the rise and fall of World Championship Wrestling here on Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here for the final segment on the show. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We're here for a minute. Talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. We spent the entire 2 hours talking the rise and fall of WCW. I spent a lot of time early talking about the pre-Monday Night War period. What a mistake. I knew we'd never get it all done in 2 hours, but I didn't think we'd run out of time like we ran out of time here. So, final question today, Mike. I'll let you wrap it up. What is the legacy of WCW?
Legacy of WCW is... like I said earlier on, it was a supernova. It was... you know, out there forever, and then everything just kind of formed together, and they take off and then burn out so incredibly quickly. Again, it for a lot of ways, from contracts, from business points of view, from agents, from in-ring presentation, to all of those things. I mean, it was incredibly, incredibly, you know, an important cog in the machine of professional wrestling. There have been how many boom periods? There was the 50s, there was the Hulkamania years, and then there was that one. And that was the one that kind of put everything over the top and changed wrestling more dramatically than any other time in the history of wrestling, I think, outside of, you know, its creation of turning into a work. This was it. I mean, for everything that's happened and the inspiration and the ground it's laid afterwards, for good and for bad, and there actually has been a lot of good that came out of it, you know, in a lot of ways, too. Especially, you know, pro wrestler, you know, it was just, again, it was a incredibly amazing time to live through, and it does leave it's a tarnished legacy, but it is a incredibly influential legacy.
And God knows if we'll ever have a boom period again. We barely scratched the surface here, everybody. If you want more, Death of WCW is the book to buy. Not just saying that because I wrote it, but it covers this whole amazing period in great detail. And like I said, we didn't get to get as in-depth today as I would have liked. We only need about 30 hours, quite frankly. But we did as much as we could in 2 hours. Maybe someday we'll do another show like this again. Maybe delve more specifically into certain periods of time, but did the best we could. We'll talk to y'all next week, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network.